Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Muliwa Gabaza, and for today, we get into a conversation that we've had in a number of different flavors on this platform, and that is around digital payments. And for today, we're going to be chatting with the team from ACI Worldwide, trying to get a sense of their take when it comes to payments. What I'm really looking forward to when it comes to this discussion, because whether we're talking to the banks or whether we're talking to the fintech players, we tend to talk quite a bit with players from the region and on the African continent. But here we're talking to a more global business, and one that is based outside. So it'll be great to get a take of what the payments landscape is looking like in that part of the world, and that how that feeds into the broader financial inclusion discussion that is being had in places like South Africa and on the African continent. So to make sense of it all for us, we are joined by Thomas Warsop. He says I can call him Tom, and he is the CEO and president of ACI Worldwide. They are a payments provider. Tom, greetings to you today.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Now, can we please maybe begin by getting the elevator pitch on, ACI, just so that people understand, your context and your interest when it comes to this payments discussion?
Yeah, sure. So ACI powers the world's payments ecosystem. So, and that's a big statement, but it's really true. We serve every one of the world's 20 largest banks. We serve many of the world's largest merchants, and we serve billers, people that send bills and want to be paid throughout the United States. We're the largest player in that space. So we are a software and services provider. So our software gets used by all of those entities I just talked about every day. Many billions of times, literally billions of payments every day go across our software, and that amounts to trillions of US dollars. So massive scale. Our key to success is that we provide that scalability, ultra reliability. We know that being one of the premier providers of payment software and facilitating all those payments, it's absolutely critical that we provide extremely high reliability, and that's what we do. We've been in business for 50 years, so we're not a startup. We've been doing this a very long time, and you were just talking about, of course, Africa and particularly South Africa. I was in South Africa 2 weeks ago, well, about 10 days ago now, and I had a chance to visit every single one of our many customers in South Africa, and it's actually one of our larger development centers in the world. So we are a global player, as you mentioned. We have about 150 developers, software engineers in South Africa. So we have a lot of talent, a lot of history, and really great relationships with our customers and people in South Africa.
Maybe just as a way so that people can get a firmer grasp of what's going on, when it comes to software providers such as yourselves, I like to think of it like people often in banking and payments talk about rails. I also like to think of it within the context of plumbing as well. They often say that, you've got the rails, upon which your payments are being deployed, but there's certain infrastructure, certain plumbing, that's making sure that everything is, going from one point to the other, whether it's from your bank account into maybe some escrow, something in the middle, and then, to the other side, maybe a clearinghouse, and then maybe a wallet, whatever it is that's happening in the middle. So your software in particular, what has tended to be some of the big things that you guys are currently helping, you know, when it comes to that payments ecosystem right now? What are maybe some of the top areas that you guys are enabling?
Yeah, so pretty much any payment vehicle you can name, those rails that you were just talking about, our software will facilitate the movement of across those, any of them, from credit card payments, debit card payments, SWIFT transfers, wire transfers in the United States, real-time payments, on that entire spectrum. And one of the things that we do is, if I boil down our strategy, our global strategy, into one phrase, it would be intelligent payments orchestration. So it's how do you move the money across all those various rails, all those regions, all those countries in the world in the most efficient and effective way. So when a payment comes into that ecosystem, one of the things that our software can do is pinpoint the best route to go to get from your bank account to my bank account, for example, or vice versa. You know, if I owe you money, how do I send it to you? And we do that every day, millions and millions and millions of times.
All right. I think that gives us a much from a grasp of, you know, what's going. I think because you have such an interesting view, and you guys have been around for so long. When you said 50 years just now, in my head, I just couldn't help but to think about the rise of some of the large digital payments providers, because 50 or so years sort of is after, if I remember correctly, it's a few years after your Visa, your MasterCards, people trying to, you know, come to terms with, you know, the ability of making a payment in one part of the world and it going, you know, to the other side. And, you know, back in those days, we're still using Magstrip, you know, and, you know, that type of thing. So keen to get your sense of maturity when it comes to payment systems, I guess, in this part of the world, you know, versus where you are. I think whenever people come, especially from the US into South Africa, one of the things that they find interesting is EFTs, as opposed to checks. Yeah. So, you know, maybe your sense around that.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting. You were talking about 50 years ago and you mentioned Visa. Well, if I remember the timing right, I'm just old enough to remember 50 years ago. I'm more than 50, but I don't remember my early years. But I think if I'm remembering it right, you're right. That was about the time that Visa became a thing. And before it was called Visa, it was the Bank America. So it was Bank of America began. But you said Magstripe. It was worse than that. We used to call them knuckle busters. You know, they're the machines that you would put the card in there and then a carbon paper and you do that. So it was even worse, that the technology. But, you know, that newer technologies emerged pretty quickly. Then you had the mag stripes, then you have the chips. And now many of these transactions are moving off the card entirely. Even if they're using a credit account that has a card associated with it, many of those transactions no longer require the card to be present at all. And you can use a wallet, as you mentioned, the wallet. There are many ways you can use a wallet. You can have it be representative of a credit account, which has a card. You can have a real-time payment account, which doesn't even have a card, doesn't even necessarily have a bank account associated with it. You can store value on your phone or other device, or, you know, there are many ways to do that. So I think, you know, the world has moved so much in that 50 years. And it's, I think at the end of the day, the big advantage is that now money moves virtually instantaneously. And what that allows us as consumers to do is to make use of the money that we have, wherever it is, in whatever form it is, we can use it easily, quickly, and relatively inexpensively. If you think about it from the perspective of a government or a central bank, the advantage is, if you think in the old days, and in some parts of the world, this is still the case, you know, where many transactions were cash based. I'm an economist by training, so when I think about the velocity of money, you know, how many times can a dollar, I'll use the U.S. dollar, right, or a rand, how many times can a rand be used at any given time? If it's cash, the answer to that is one, right? You can use that piece of currency, that coin, once at one time. If it becomes an electronic payment, theoretically, you can use that same money multiple times at once and in rapid succession. And so that allows that velocity of money to increase, which increases the money supply or the effective money supply, and allows central banks to drive more growth in economies, makes it easier for consumers to do what they need to do. So many, many advantages. And this is the general theme we're seeing everywhere in the world, is this move from cash to electronic payments to instant payments. And various regions around the world are in different spots there. Africa is actually the world leader, at the continent of Africa, is the world leader in the percentage of non-paper transactions, so non-cash transactions, that are instant payments, that are done immediately through these various schemes. And that's pretty impressive. Now, there's still a lot of room to grow because a lot of that volume is in Nigeria and the rest of Africa is catching up. But big opportunities for financial inclusion. You mentioned that earlier. That's another big benefit because, as I said, you don't have to even have a bank account to use instant payments and to use a wallet on a mobile device or otherwise. So it's a very exciting time. We're seeing tremendous growth in the use of electronic payments generally, and particularly instant or real-time payments. And in Africa, as I said, the continent is a leader. And there are schemes in many countries now in Africa. The one in South Africa is called PayShop, and we're seeing steady growth in the use of that scheme in South Africa as well.
You know what, Tom? One of the things that I've found is that when it comes to, I guess, comparing and contrasting different rates of maturity, it always helps to understand, I guess, different context. Right. And sometimes there's this impression sometimes that Africa tends to be behind when it comes to, you know, certain innovations. But you're saying that when it comes to digital payments, that the continent is actually, you know, quite well developed in a number of different countries. I think you called out Nigeria and obviously, you know, South Africa, but in South Africa specifically, there's this ongoing war against cash. That's what I like to call it. The banks, the fintech guys, there's so much, you know, push to try and digitize payments, even from, the central bank and government, right? Issues of security. I also have my background, you know, from an economist's point of view. So when you talk about velocity of money, you are preaching to the choir, you know, when it comes to that. But maybe we could get a sense, because people here understand some of the issues around cash, but, being based in the United States, how's the cash situation in the United States? How's the war on cash in the US? I guess from an impression point of view, we would think that the US would be the most advanced economy when it would come to digital payments, but maybe you have a different view for us.
Well, the United States, the number of electronic payments has increased dramatically for a long time in the US. And, that's a fact. Interestingly, though, the total volume of cash transactions hasn't gone down that much. So the share of total payments that are electronic has gone up. But the total payments has gone up almost as much. And so the cash continues to be actually quite a large part of the economy. And you know, you said something really important, and I talk about this a lot. There's a tendency to think, well, the United States, largest economy in the world, they must be the leader in lots of things. And one of the things is real-time payments. U.S. must be the leader in real-time payments. Not at all. Not even close. And the leader in real-time payments in the world is India by long, long way. And there are many reasons for that. But I think one of the benefits of having an economy that maybe didn't quite keep up with some of the advances over this 50-year period is you actually don't have to move from one electronic payments, you know, scheme as much to real-time payments. You can go straight to it. You can leapfrog some of the things that didn't really work all as well as we thought they might and go straight to something that's quite efficient and gets money from A to B immediately. And that's the real-time payment. So I think in a funny way, there's some advantages to, you know, over the last 20 or 30 years, people thinking, oh, Africa's behind. Well, not anymore. You know, Africa's had the opportunity to leapfrog. India similarly, China similarly, Brazil as well. So those are the largest real-time payment markets in the world that I just named. And they've been able to take that leadership position to some extent because they didn't have the embedded infrastructure. Because there are a lot of people in the United States that make a lot of money from the rails that you were talking about and these, you know, the credit card rails, the debit card rails. A lot of people make a lot of money from that. So there's resistance to change. And then the other driver in the U.S. is Americans like me have gotten very comfortable with rewards for using their credit cards. And those rewards are they're like cash back or frequent flyer points or, you know, there are various things you can get, all funded by the merchants through the interchange. And the interchange is, you know, 1.5% to 3% of a transaction. So it's very expensive. If you think about a real-time payment, it's a fraction of that is the actual cost. Now, there aren't any rewards, but that's because the cost is so much lower and you don't have the money to fund it. So I think Africa is in a good spot. I think they're going to be very rapid. There's going to be very rapid adoption of these newer technologies, newer ways of paying, and I think it will benefit everybody.
All right. Makes sense when you put it in that way. The reason why I had asked the question like that is because, you know, in essence, you guys are a global company, right? But you're also listed. So there's a number of push and pull factors when it comes to making your capital allocation decisions. So I guess maturity of a market is one of those. Opportunity, then becomes one of the other ones. So I wanted to get a sense of when you're looking at the world, you know, if we're looking at ACI as a kingdom, right? How are you thinking around capital allocation in the various parts of the world based on the maturity that, you know, that we're talking about? Because we don't have the cheap money that we had a couple of years ago. Yes, interest rates are starting to turn. That's a good thing, but it's certainly not what it was a couple of years ago. So that also informs risk appetite in quite a big way. So yeah, just keen to get your sense of how you're thinking around capital allocation in the different parts of the world where you guys do business.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, just to build on what you were saying, I think the era of free money, because that's what it was, right? I mean, money was literally free. The cost of debt was lower than even a very conservative view of a return. So money was essentially free. And people made decisions based on that. That era is over. I can't see that coming back. Yes, rates are coming down a bit, even in the U.S., but I just don't see us getting back to that that effectively zero or negative rates. So, but your question is a good one, and as the CEO of a public company, I have to think of two big categories of opportunities when I think about how do I allocate capital. Number one is I obviously have to meet commitments to shareholders, and I have to make sure that my the current revenues and profit are being generated as expected. And for that, we usually look primarily to the more developed markets. So the US, Europe, parts of Asia, we make money when payments happen across any rail, actually. And so the largest volumes of payments, electronic, we don't make money on cash transactions. So it's all electronic payments. Because we're a software provider. So those the largest volumes of those payments are in those regions, the North America, Europe, and then parts of Asia. The faster growing regions are for the future. We need to make sure that we are well positioned, and we think we are, to grow with these regions as electronic payments continue to grow. And that's driven for a number of reasons. But you know, as the economy itself grows, more transactions. And then as new payment vehicles are adopted, like real-time payments or instant payments, you see even more growth. So we are, so we think about it that way. For current expectations of revenue and profit, that's primarily coming from the more developed markets. We expect that that to shift over time as markets develop faster in Africa, Latin America, Asia, and then parts of the Middle East.
I like the way that you are sort of walking us through some of those decisions, and especially the more immediate versus the more, let's call it, medium to long-term type of view that you sort of have to make when it comes to making these decisions. Because I think one of the things I'm most curious about is to say, because you have to be balancing the present versus what's going to happen, you know, down the line, and emerging markets present such a compelling investment case, especially for digital payments providers such as yourselves, is to say, when it comes to, I understand the regional aspect, but what about the technology question? And when I say technology question, I mean there are different rails, card, some people have the wallet, some people are now, I think crypto is becoming a little bit more mainstream now. There's different ways in which people are, you know, looking at this. For you, where in which basket are you placing your, what you call this, your eggs? In South Africa, the banks have almost unanimously agreed that card is probably going to be one of the biggest growth areas. And then they thought it was going to be the mobile phone, but the structure of the economy is a bit different. So card will likely be the one that continues going forward. In your view?
Yeah, I think so one thing to understand about the way we think about electronic payments is we are relatively indifferent which rails a payment travels over. It's not a big issue for us because the world has a finite number of transaction types and message formats. So there are standards worldwide in terms of one of the newer ones is called ISO 20022. I always forget how many zeros there are in that, but that's one of the newer standards. It's a very rich standard. Lots of data comes with it. It allows the participants in a payment transaction to do many interesting things, understand more about the payment and process it better, prevent fraud, in a better way, lots of things that you'd want to do. But there are many of these standards, but there's a finite number. And so our solutions, we are fine with the various standards. We don't mind. And the way we build our products is that we build the foundation, because handling a payment is handling a payment. It's the movement of, it's a message at the end of the day. It's going from one place to another saying, okay, you have money that belongs to Madiwa. I want it to go to Tom. Do that, please. Once we authenticate, make sure there's no fraud, that happens. And it flows across a rail. It has a message standard. So we don't mind which standard it is. We work with essentially all of them. So that's all good. What we do is we facilitate those transactions. We allow governments, banks, consumers, commercial customers to transact efficiently and at the lowest possible cost, picking the rail that makes the most sense, as I was telling you earlier. So we understand these various payment types, these message types. We understand all of them. And it's one of the advantages that we have, because we are indifferent to that. We just want to make sure that the payments ecosystem works very smoothly.
Nice. So when you come to South Africa, as you did earlier on in September, to engage with your various customers and the industry, what are you curious about going into such a trip? What can I call it, a takeaway or a surprise? When you get back on the plane to go back, to the US?
Yeah, I think not really a surprise, but a really pleasant thing was the conversations that I had with our customers in South Africa were very future looking. So sometimes I sit down with a customer and they want to talk about, can I get a discount on my service? That's a pretty common question. I don't think I'm alone in that. I think many CEOs hear that. I get that. Or I get, tell me about your next product that you're going to launch. And we talked about those things, but really what we talked about more than anything was, what's the future of payments? How are things going to shift? And we talked a lot about PayShap and the growth in the use of that vehicle. But we also talked a lot about what the possibilities are in the future. So for example, today that vehicle basically can be used in South Africa. That's great. You want to do a transaction inside South Africa, great, use that. In the future, what will be possible is cross-border transactions using real-time payments schemes. That's very limited at this point in the world. So India has some pilots going on with Singapore, for example. So you could use UPI, which is the Indian real-time payments platform. You can use UPI in Singapore now in a limited way. Pix in Brazil has a pilot with some merchants in Argentina. So you can use it just in very limited way. So those are interesting, but those aren't really needle movers. But as the world, as this technology continues to mature, and it's really not a technology issue because the technology is already there. We don't mind if it's a cross-border transaction or inside a country. It doesn't really matter. The technology is the same. The challenges that have to be overcome are primarily regulatory. So the central banks of the various countries need to agree on how does that work? What are the rules regarding a cross-border transaction? And then there's a foreign exchange. So who's going to make sure that the risk of that foreign exchange happens? Once those two things are sorted out, and they're not terribly difficult to sort out, but it's falling. So, it'll take some time. But once those are sorted out, now you're going to have ways of moving money across borders around the world immediately and inexpensively and efficiently. And that gets super interesting. And so back to your question, when I was in South Africa, we talked a lot about that, about what happens when we can, very simply move money from Uganda to South Africa, from South Africa to Morocco, whatever it is. That gets really interesting. You can provide all kinds of new services to your customer as a bank. You can create new fee structures. You can change your pricing model, deliver more value. Lots of great things are possible when that happens. And that's what I spent most of the time talking about.
Yeah, and it's actually great, you know, to hear that those are the types of, discussions that people are having. We've actually had a number of those discussions on this platform about, ubiquity of some of the different, payments methods that have become popular, you know, on the continent, such as mobile money. You know, how do you integrate some of those? How do you integrate that as a rail into what are seen as more, mainstream type of transactions? But with M-Pesa, you can play for Showmax and Spotify and Netflix and all of this stuff, that people are doing. But just curious, before we let you go, then Thomas, to say, you mentioned earlier on something about resistance in a place like the US when it comes to some of the, you know, new payment methods. But because you have this global view, for you guys, you're agnostic. You don't care what the rail is as long as more money is moving from one place to another. But I'm sure as more rails open up, it means that your volume of transactions is going up, which is, I guess, in the interests of an ACI, right? Where is the resistance? You sort of painted a picture for us around how some of the factors driving resistance in a place like the US. But in other parts of the world, when it comes to, I guess, some of the resistance to digital payment, or at least hurdles, right? Because, you know, some things are intentionally resistive, whereas others, it's just a matter of circumstance. So how have you seen that playing out in different, in some of the spots of the world that you're looking at?
Yeah, so some of it's cultural. If I look at a place like Japan, let's say. So Japan's a very advanced economy and very technologically adept. But there's a cultural aspect that their share of transactions that are still cash is quite high for a very developed economy. And it's I didn't grow up in Japan, so I can't really explain it, but I know it is true. And that economy will take a bit longer because of this cultural resistance. So that's one element. Another element I mentioned already is economic resistance, because in the US you have these rewards, which are very appealing, and consumers don't really want to let go of those rewards. And they say, well, you know, why would I do that? Because I'm not paying for that reward. The merchant is paying. Well, of course, the consumer is paying, but you don't feel it directly. So there's going to have to be some sort of an incentive for consumers to move to a real-time payment. It's actually happening already, where now I was at a restaurant yesterday, and when the bill came, it said there's a discount if you use cash or a low-cost payment method. If you use a card, it costs what's on the bill. So there's my incentive, right? It's coming. And so that will happen. And then there's a really dark reason why you're going to get some resistance. The bad people in the world that do really bad things, they probably will not want to use these types of electronic payment rails, because you can track those transactions so much better than you can cash, for example. So that's a very limited thing, but it is true. You tend to see, drug traffickers, for example, they still use cash and lots of it. And I don't think they're going to be adopters of instant payments, or although maybe crypto, I don't know. But that's a small thing. But you have different reasons around the world that there's resistance. And there is everywhere in the world. the share of payments that are electronic continues to increase. The volume of payments in general continues to increase. And the use of real-time payments, instant payments, it depends on what part of the world you're in, what you call it, but that continues to increase as well. And we're going to see that for a long time. Cash is not going to go away completely in my lifetime, but I think you will continue to see the share of transactions conducted with cash going down. And I think that's a good thing. It's safer, faster, much more efficient.
I think where we're going to end off is something that you've just brought up now, you know, around maybe the darker side. You mentioned the fact that your more nefarious actors have an incentive to keep using cash. But on the other side of that same coin, you have a lot of critics of digital payments who then argue to say, but well, you're opening up people to a cyber risk around, you know, their money, right? And someone,
absolutely,
someone might look at an ACI and say, well, if something happens to ACI, we're all at risk or something like that. So, you know, what tends to be your response when that type of criticism comes out?
Yeah, well, first of all, bad actors are really smart. They're very well funded. And the cyber crime is projected to be the largest industry in the world in the next few years. That's a scary, scary thought, but it's I hear this often. So the only way to go on this is to do your very best to stay ahead of the bad guys and to put enough defenses in their way that you prevent or at least reduce exposure. At ACI, we've been pioneers in fraud detection and prevention, because at the end of the day, that's what we're talking about. It's fraud, right? These are people that shouldn't have access to your money that are trying to get access to you. And I mean, I understand the point that people make about when you move from cash to electronic, it introduces this new kind of fraud risk. Well, the way I look at it, that's, yes, it's a different risk, but that risk exists with cash at least as much, because people steal cash. You know, they take it right out of your pocket. They con you into giving them cash, right? The same types of risk. It's just different, a little bit different application. But we have products that we build in at the foundational level of that, the transfer of money that we've been talking about this entire time. We build those in to detect patterns that we have seen before and or that are suggestive of a movement of money that isn't appropriate. And we've been doing this for a long time. I mentioned we've been in business for 50 years. We've been using artificial intelligence to detect fraudulent transactions and prevent them for more than 25 years. And, you know, a lot of people will say to me, oh, well, this AI thing, it's a brand new thing. It's not a brand new thing. AI has been around for a long time. It at various times, it's been called machine learning, algorithmic operations, AI, you know, generative AI now. They're all flavors of a similar thing. And we've been using AI for a long, long time, and we are very good at detecting fraud and preventing false positives. Because the key to fraud detection and preventing fraud is, yes, you have to detect fraud, but what you don't want to do is alert someone to a transaction and say, we think that's fraud, if it isn't. Because if it isn't fraud, what has actually happened is you have prevented a legitimate transaction from occurring. And you don't want to do that. So we are very good. Our products are very good at detecting fraud, preventing false positives. And we believe, so, you know, we have great products, but we believe no matter what you do to prevent and detect and prevent fraud, you need to build it into the foundation of your payment mechanisms, those rails. It needs to be, because the more visibility you can get to all sides of a transaction, the more likely it is you're going to be able to detect and prevent that fraud. If you only see one side of a transaction, it can be quite difficult to understand whether that's a good or a bad transaction.
All right. So that's how we conclude today's, very fascinating discussion around what's going on in the world of payments. Really great to understand from a different view, what's happening in the world of, digital payments. And one of the things that I liked that, Tom highlighted at the beginning is the fact that when you're looking at different regions in the world, there tends to be a view that your biggest economy is going to be the most advanced on digital payments, but that is not the case. And he points to a number of countries such as India with their UPI, as well as China as being some of the global leaders when it comes to real-time payments. And he actually says that Africa as a continent has actually been quite ahead of the curve when it comes to this. And then he led us through some of the factors that are helping some of the more advanced regions in the world versus maybe some of the resistance when you're dealing with some of the more legacy issues in the systems. And speaking of that legacy, he did say that sometimes not having the legacy in place has actually proved to be an advantage because it has meant that certain economies have been able to leapfrog when it comes to their digital payments journey, also giving us some insight into some of the discussions that he was having when in South Africa with some of their clients, which I assume is, the big banks, and talking about the fact that it's all, a big thing that is preoccupying the industry right now is what is the future of payments, and what are some of the things that need to be taken out of the system to actually help to push that in a further way. And for someone like ACI, it was also good to hear that for them, it's not really about the type of technology, the type of payment method, the type of rail, as we call it. But as long as people are transacting digitally, then someone like ACI is making money in the system. So if we are able to grow the pie, as a whole, then, those are the things that are going to do well. And then obviously ending off, talking about the security factor, perhaps as a way to put a bow on the conversation around cash versus digital payments, to say that there's risks on both sides. But as far as, the likes of ACI are concerned, and Tom, you're likely going to have a better time with digital payments as opposed to the risks that are associated with cash. Obviously, at some point, we delved a little bit into economic theory around velocity of money, but it was just a really great discussion to understand what's going on in the world of digital payments. Have I left out anything, Tom, before we let you go?
That was a great summary.
No, I'm really really glad to hear that. So that was us. We were in conversation with Thomas Warsop. He is CEO and president over at ACI Worldwide. Tom, thank you so much for being with us today.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So from myself and the rest of the team, it is a good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.